All robust technology platforms require testing to ensure that features work as intended. In many cases, tests require data, but getting access to valid and high-quality test data is a common challenge, especially when the technology runs on sensitive data. Realistically, mimicking data that would normally contain sensitive financial or personal information is not easy. Tonic AI was started in 2018 to provide developer tools to transform production data into safe testing data. Andrew Colombi is the CTO and Adam Kamor is the head of engineering at Tonic. They join the show to talk about creating realistic synthetic data, data de-identification, validating LLM RAG output, Tonic subsetting engine, and much more. Gregor Vand is a security-focused technologist and is the founder and CTO of MailPass. Previously, Gregor was a CTO across cybersecurity, cyber insurance, and general software engineering companies. He has been based in Asia Pacific for almost a decade and can be found via his profile at vand.hk.
Hi, Andrew and Adam. Welcome to Software Engineering Daily.
Hey, thanks so much for having us. We're really excited to be here today.
Yeah, it's great to have you both here today. A nice change for us here on Software Engineering Daily to have two guests. So you are two of the, I believe, is it four co-founders of Tonic?
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah, and we're going to hear a lot more about Tonic shortly, which is exciting. But maybe, Adam, do you want to first just, you know, introduce yourself and what was your road to co-founding Tonic?
Oh, certainly. We're going to hop right in. So my name's Adam. I'm Tonic's head of engineering and, as you said, one of its co-founders. God, the road to starting Tonic. Well, a lot of it is being in the right place at the right time and luck. I think that's true of a lot of endeavors, frankly. For me, the lucky part was having worked at Tableau Software in Seattle back in 2017, where I met Ian. Ian is Tonic's CEO and one of our other co-founders, and him and I worked on the same team at Tableau. We were both on the product management side, and we got to know each other. We were friendly. We both respected each other's, you know, work ethic, hustle, you know, just like abilities in the engineering space. And at some point, it became clear we were both kind of interested in starting a company, and there was, you know, we knew each other, I think, for 2 years before that really happened. But what ended up happening is I left Seattle to move back to Atlanta for family reasons. And then Ian ended up leaving Tableau in Seattle to move to San Francisco. And then I got a call from him one day saying, hey, Adam, you know, I'm thinking about starting a company. I have these partners that I'm working with, you know, one of them being on the call today. And he asked if I was interested in kind of like, you know, brainstorming with them and kind of like iterating on some ideas and building some, you know, silly little, you know, like demo software, you know, demoware. And I fortunately agreed, and the rest is history.
That's cool. I didn't realize the sort of common Tableau part of the history there, so that's fun to know.
That's right. I am the outlier, though. I think I'm, you know, I know Ian, but the other three co-founders all know each other a lot better, and I'm sure Andrew's going to talk about that.
Right. So yeah, Andrew, what was your road to co-founding Tonic?
Yeah. My lucky moment was working at Palantir with Ian and Carl. I actually hired both Ian and Carl to their roles at Palantir, and I was their boss for a little while, and now the tables have turned. Ian's the CEO and our business daddy. And, you know, I was working at Palantir with them. We worked on a lot of data things, of course. We were at Palantir. We even kind of explored this problem, I think, independently with Ian and with Carl. I did like synthetic data projects. I think I did it first maybe with Carl, and then later, because we were working on like some project for Palantir. It was with like a big bank, and we needed data for testing, as you do. And so I was like, you know what? I can do this. I'm just going to make some synthetic data for them. And I was like, you know, how hard can fake data be? We're going to do this in like a week and we'll be good to go. And like weeks later, I'm still like figuring out Poisson distributions and recalling how a hidden Markov model would work and stuff like that. And I realized how hard this problem was. But the cool part about it was it also ended up being more valuable than I thought it would be. So we like, you know, did this project for this banking customer that we had, but then we were using it in like demos to other banks or demos to, you know, even outside of the banking industry. And then later Ian had a project in a totally different space. It was like a media website kind of a thing. And they were looking to analyze and work with data about traffic and figure out what their customer patterns were and, I don't know, ad revenue, yada, yada. So I was like, hey, I got this tool set that I built with Carl to do synthetic data. We can use it to test the software that we're building for this customer. And so I did it again with them, with Ian. And that was really cool. And then, you know, years passed. I quit Palantir. And I was working on a video game with my sister. And I was just, yeah, working on the video game. And then Ian was like, hey, we're working on this thing. And I was like, I'm a pretty crappy video game developer, but I'm like really good at data. So it's probably the better choice for my career to go do this data thing with him. And fortunately, I was able to bring my sister along for the ride. She is now in our marketing team. So that's really cool.
One of our first employees, our first hires.
Yeah. It was kind of like my rider, you know, like you want me, you get my sister.
Right.
And no regrets, I think, on the founding team. I mean, she's.
And let me say, I mean, Andrew is in fact excellent at data. And I did see an early demo of his video game, and I'm glad he switched.
So, yeah, that's kind of my story. And no regrets. It's been a wild ride. And I can always go back to the video game at some point.
Yeah, you wouldn't be the first developer to try video games and end up not doing it. I keep dreaming about that, and I haven't even tried it. So at least you go that far. So that's very cool. So let's talk about Tonic. Let's talk about, I believe, you know, at the kind of the start of Tonic, there was and sort of is, there's a core platform that is Tonic. And then there are more products on that have come since then. And we're going to talk about those as well. But what was the sort of the founding product and what is the core platform?
You know, actually, we're about to kind of rechristen Tonic, Core Tonic, as Tonic Structural. And that's to differentiate it from Tonic Textual, which is one of our new products that you're alluding to. But yeah, the core idea behind Tonic Structural was this idea of working with structured data and creating great fake test data that was in the structured data domain. So structured data, we mean databases with rows and columns and tables, but we also mean JSON documents. Those are structured enough for us. We don't mean, you know, a random text blob of data. And that's come later in Tonic's life. But, you know, the beginning was just, you know, this idea that people need test data. Everyone needs test data. And applications are built on top of databases like Postgres and MySQL, et cetera. And, you know, there isn't great tools out there for doing this. So that's what we kind of set out to do. And I was actually looking at our blog recently, and some of the core things that we built the product around at the very beginning in like the summer of 2018 and like the fall of 2018, we founded in May of 2018, are still like the core things that people buy Tonic for today, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. We got at least one thing right. You know, Andrew and I, you know, Andrew's right. Like our primary use case for Tonic Structural has been for providing de-identified or synthetic data to engineering teams so they can do development and test. But that same tool using the same technology is able to kind of like satisfy other use cases as well. Definitely secondary use cases. Like they're not our main bread and butter, but you know, they still sell. And it's for things like generating demo data sets for sales demos or for de-identifying data sitting in a large data warehouse or data lake for, you know, safe analytics purposes. So that, you know, the tool is kind of like naturally evolved to fit these other use cases using the same like underlying technology, which is great because, you know, obviously we want to be constantly making the pie bigger. But still, it's like, as Andrew said, since day one, it's been about dev and test data, and that remains true today.
So walk me through, I imagine there's maybe two cases here. We've got one, I guess, where a product is fairly new and actually, but it's going to need a ton of data to understand, is this product going to work the way that the developers are sort of intending it to. The other side, I guess, is there is tons of data already in there, but it's not okay for the developers to have access to the real data. So could you maybe walk us through kind of those two scenarios or any other scenarios? Like, how does it work is what I'm interested in.
So of those two scenarios, we primarily see the second scenario. That's where the need and the demand seems to be. So I'll speak to that. But like, I guess before I do, I will say that like, if you have a new application and you have a need to kind of like fill a database with data so that you can like test the application to see how it behaves, that's possible to do with our product and with other products as well. But our product relies on there being an existing set of data in the database so that we can create something for you that is super realistic. If you come to us just with an empty database, yeah, we can fill it with data that'll satisfy constraints, that'll adhere to the correct data types of the schema, etc. But it's going to be garbage. And like maybe that's fine for what you're trying to test, but it can't be realistic if we don't have anything to base it off of. You know, the alternative would be, well, it's like, okay, well, I'll just generate rules for how every column has to be generated, right? But then what you end up doing in that case is you have to come up with a rule set that is basically as complex as like the business logic of your application. And that becomes like difficult to do very quickly and doesn't really scale well. And people typically like shy away from doing that quickly. Like, you know, to Andrew's point earlier where he was having to use Poisson processes and markup chains and all of these things, if you're kind of like having to set these rules yourselves manually, it becomes very difficult. Like it's better to use a tool like ours that kind of just looks at the existing data set and is able to create a synthetic or de-identified version of it. Andrew, do you want to take that second question on like, okay, so people come to us with, you know, a database full of data. Their developers can't access it. What do they do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, their developers can't access it. That's exactly where we come in. You know, as Adam said, we're building on top of the knowledge of your data set. And from there, we're able to recreate things like the weird business logic that you have and the weird, it's not even weird. It's like the natural phenomena in the world that are represented in a database. You know, you've got a data set of healthcare things, healthcare claims, that's a common one in like healthcare insurance. It essentially represents the real world in this kind of esoteric, arcane way that is known as a relational database. And the real world is really complicated and interesting and rich. And that's why, you know, we believe the best data comes from data that exists, because then we can learn about these real world phenomena and recreate them.
Yeah, that's right. I think you can possibly bucket, like the people that come for use case two, Gregor, the one that you said where they have data, they just can't access it. Really, I think those users can be bucketed into one of two groups. It's like there's development teams that can no longer access production data, so that they have to create their own like staging and development databases. And they're typically very poor imitations of production. Like they lack the complexity and plethora of combinations that exist in production. They lack the edge cases, and they certainly lack the scale of production. That is to say, the number of rows. For those customers, you bring in Tonic. Tonic essentially overnight is giving you high quality data that looks and feels just like production, and it's at the same scale as production. So for those teams, Tonic becomes a developer productivity tool. We've just made your development team way more efficient because they get more realistic data to work with. And then we have customers that are actually today using their production data in their lower environments for dev and test. Typically, there's a lot of red tape associated with that. It's hard to do things because you have to have the same controls in place on dev and staging that you do in production now. But for those customers, we're typically more thought of as a privacy tool, right? Before, they were doing something that really wasn't safe. They were giving everyone access to production data. Okay, well, now they're not. And you get the same amount of efficiency with a little bit less red tape as well.
I think that's a good thing to call out, that there are really two sides to this. And, you know, your mission statement very much clearly says this, that on the one side, this is about making developers more productive. But on the other side, it is about that everyone has a human right, effectively, to data privacy. And I think the majority of people out there probably never have realized that a lot of the data, okay, it's not out there in the public, so to speak, but developers, unfortunately, have often had access to data that they should not have had access to.
Yeah, I mean, it is in the it's in the public in a sense, right? It's like these people that you've never interacted with or aware of have access to data. And there's a couple of things that really makes me proud of working at Tonic. One is that, you know, that we're unequivocally doing something good in the world. I think a lot of companies, a lot of tech companies especially, have like these lofty mission statements. And we don't even have a lofty mission statement. I don't think you'll find one on our website, or like, you know, you go to like About or whatever, company core values. It doesn't exist on the website. But it's just like pretty clear in the founding of the company and what the company does. It's like we protect people's data. That's what we do. And then the other thing that I think is really cool about working at Tonic is we also get to work on like really gnarly computer science problems. I mean, lots of places get to work on cool problems too, like, you know, especially scale problems or as you grow a company in terms of like the technology and what have you. But we get to also work on like really mathy problems. And yeah, and if you want to understand the insides of a database, Tonic is a good place to learn that stuff.
Yeah, certainly.
And in terms of how that data gets, I guess, populated by Tonic, is it table by table, or are there actually links where tables that have data that rely on other tables, there's now links there as well?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, I think we have some of the best technology for quickly loading data into a database because, I mean, that's like our principal performance bottleneck is getting data into a database for the most part. It depends on the database, but some databases are really good at ingesting data, like Snowflake, for example. But, you know, if you're talking about Postgres or Oracle, then yeah, that's like a principal part of the technology. And there are a lot of different ways we traverse the table graph. The table graph is sort of like the graph of tables using foreign keys as a way to, that's the edges and the nodes or the tables themselves. There are a lot of different ways that we traverse that graph depending on what we're doing. We have this technology, another technology really proud of, the subsetting technology, which shrinks a database. And it does that by starting with a target table or more than one target table, taking a portion of that target table and then using that seed set of rows to expand throughout the rest of the database and collect all the rest of the data associated with those rows. So that would be like, you know, if let's say you're an e-commerce website and you collect some users of your e-commerce website, you'd be getting their purchases, the actual rows that represent the items they purchased, their address book, their, you know, credit card book or wallet or whatever you want to call it, and like, you know, hundreds of tables that are being kind of touched by these core set of original rows that you collect. So that technology right there is fundamentally like a technology around how do you traverse the graph of tables. And yeah, it's too complicated without visuals to explain on this podcast, but it's a really cool piece of technology. We have some ancient blog posts about it that are a little bit cringy when you look back at them, just in terms of like, we were like, you know, it'll sell a funny blog post title. If our blog post title is hilarious, people are going to click a hell out of it. And so, you know, we had something like Honey, I Shrunk the Database.
That was my idea.
Like, I don't think most of our readers would even connect with that at this point. It's like an old movie.
I actually just watched that movie with my kids recently. They loved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a kid's movie. So anyway, yeah, there's like some really meaty technology problems underlying there. And funny titles didn't make a difference. We were still unknown.
Yes. But we got some of our first customers from the open source library Condenser.
Yes.
Early on, there's a lot of noise out there. Every company's trying to get your attention, and trying to get your slice of that attention is a real challenge. Like, you know, we were trying things like Andrew's saying, like funny blog posts and, you know, things like this, and it doesn't really work. But one thing we did that was successful but very expensive for us was to actually open source some of this technology. And the original subsetting engine we wrote in Python, we called it Condenser because it condenses things. And it got us our first customer. I think that's correct, Andrew, isn't it?
I don't know. Maybe.
It did. I don't want to say the name of the customer because I'm not sure what our logo rights are with them, but it got us our first customer because they actually filed an issue on the repo. And then that started some conversations with them. And then that eventually led to commercials. And, you know, I mean, at the time we were writing this, it was just like, I don't know. It was very frustrating because we have all this cool tech. We didn't know how to get it out there. And that kind of like was really, I don't know, it was really some, you know, the wind in our sails that was very much needed at that time.
Yeah. And subsetting has been a huge thing for us. I mean, like, it's probably like 50% of our customers use subsetting, which is a pretty big deal. Like, I don't think there's any other single feature in Tonic that, except for maybe the very core UI or whatever.
Right.
But 50% of our customers use that. So that's like a pretty big penetration for us, which is really, really great.
Absolutely. And it's something that's like our subsetting engine is very unique to us. Like the underlying technology, you know, we have patents on it. Of the approaches we take, the experience, it's all patented, and it's a very good engine. And I've never seen anything really approach the level of sophistication that our subsetting engine can do.
To those that are not familiar, how would you sort of just at a high level describe subsetting, and what about Tonic's engine is kind of superior in that?
Sure. Well, I'll describe it. Andrew can say why the engine's so great, if he can think of a good reason on the spot like that. At a high level, we basically treat the database as a dependency graph. So the nodes are tables, the edges are your foreign keys. And then the user basically provides one or more target tables. These are tables that they say, hey, give me a random percent of rows from this table, like 5%, or filter this table based on this provided where clause. Then we can go and we can go reduce that table in size based on the percent or the where clause. That's the easy part. But then we have to, like, in a very special way, traverse that dependency graph of tables, bringing over only rows from other tables that are necessary to maintain referential integrity. Like at the highest level, that's what subsetting is and what it does. Why our engine is so great and sophisticated. Andrew, can you add that?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not even sure if I could answer that now.
I think the things that we really strove to do is inject determinism into our subsetting algorithm. So if you just like naturally take what Adam described as this like graph with tables as nodes and edges as foreign keys, a really trivial example of a problem is you have a cycle of foreign keys. Like you have table A has a foreign key to B, has a foreign key to C, has a foreign key back to A. And actually like an even more common thing in real world tables would be something like the table A has a foreign key to table A, like right back to itself. And if you start collecting data and you're like, okay, I got some rows from A, now I need to get some rows from B because I've got a foreign key from A to B, which means that for these rows to exist in A, I need certain rows in B. Now I follow that again to C, and now I have to go back to A. And that means I get more rows from A, which means in turn, I need to get more rows from B, more rows from C, more rows from A, B, C, and so on and so forth. And eventually you might collect the whole table, or, you know, there's no end in sight necessarily. So the thing that we really strove to do in our algorithm is make it deterministic, and maybe that's not exactly the right word, finite number of steps. That's the right word. It needed to finish in a finite number of steps. I didn't want any possibility of looping forever or looping indeterminately. So that's what we set out to do. And, you know, going into the details of how that works is complex, but the long and short of it is at upfront, before we collect a single row from the database, we have a plan. Like the algorithm comes up with a plan of attack of like how it's going to do this subsetting, and it never needs to diverge from the plan. And yeah, it's essentially a set of like traversal rules for how to explore this graph of tables that produces that. But yeah, that's the core of it, is like this finite step idea. And then there's a bunch of other stuff in there that's like really important when you know, that was like the core idea, right? It's like, we're going to do finite steps. Great. We got it. Finite steps. And then we deployed it to like the first customer. And they're like, oh, but does it handle polymorphic foreign keys? What is a polymorphic foreign key? It's like, I have a table that has two columns. One of the columns is a foreign key, like a typical foreign key, like, you know, ID goes to ID5. But the other column is like, which table does that foreign key relate to? So it's not a foreign key that you would ever see in like a Postgres database in like as a foreign key, create for or alter table, add foreign key, whatever. It's like a conceptual foreign key. And so you have all these things that are real world databases problems. You know, does it work in Oracle 11G? Does it, you know, and so like we've tackled all that too, right? Like there's this beautiful theoretical concept of it must have finite steps. And then there's the practical, like everyday getting down and dirty with a bunch of databases and actually working for people that we've added over the last 6 years that makes it really valuable as well.
And I think we'll get to this later in the podcast. Our subsetting technology has unlocked like new experiences, features, and products that we can kind of now provide to our customers. As soon as you're able to take like a 1 terabyte database and reduce it down to like a really realistic and de-identified 5 gigabytes or 1 gigabyte or, you know, what have you, you unlock a bunch of scenarios that you couldn't really do before because working with 1 terabyte is like cumbersome and difficult and time consuming and expensive. So, you know, like for example, our customers can take a subset of databases and instead of outputting them to a live database server, which is like the default mode of operating within Tonic, you know, basically, you know, give us a database, we give you back a new de-identified database. We can now output your data directly to Docker containers, for example, and then they can be pushed to customer, you know, Docker repositories like an Amazon ECR or, you know, Docker Hub or key.io, you know, what have you. And that's the thing that you couldn't do that if you were de-identifying a terabyte of data. But as soon as you're reducing it in size, you can start putting it in Docker. And then as soon as you have it in Docker, you know, you don't have to have all of your developers hammering the same dev database, you know, sitting in some RDS instance all at once. Everyone gets their own local version of the dev data to work with. Right? All they do, hey, just Docker pool, you know, container name, and then you can be up and running in minutes with your own dev data that's all local. And then, you know, we have some other products that I think we'll talk about that take that paradigm even further in terms of like making the data easily available and widespread in your organization.
Yeah, that feels huge if the data can be in itself a Docker container. And speaking of deployments, Tonic is both cloud and on-prem. What kind of differences are there between those two types of deployments, or is it pretty much the same?
Not much. Yeah, really not much. There's like a couple things about cloud that are a little easier and a couple things about self-hosted that are a little easier in terms of configuration and what have you. certainly, you know, just being honest, if a customer comes to us and says, we don't care if it's cloud or self-hosted, whatever you think is best, we would say cloud 100%. Because just in terms of like getting them set up and onboarded and us being able to understand what they're up to and being able to help them quickly, cloud is just easier and better. But we work with, you know, the most sensitive data that the org has, and thus the security teams have questions and, you know, they're not comfortable with that. And so we end up doing a lot of self-hosted. But in terms of capability, there really isn't that much of a difference. You could probably find a couple corners where one is supported and the other isn't, but yeah, it's pretty much the same.
Yeah. And of course, when you run self-hosted, like we've been doing that since day one. So our self-hosted install is like easy and quick. And assuming the customer's provisioned like an EC2 instance or a VM ahead of time, like you're up and running in Tonic in, you know, 10, 15 minutes. You can run it entirely air-gapped if you need to. Like it's all very like smooth at this point. And it definitely wasn't originally. So for your listeners today that are thinking about like selling software that customers deploy themselves, there is potentially like a long, painful road to get to a point where it's easy. If I had to give a person one piece of advice, I don't know, Andrew, if you'll agree with this or not. We make our solutions available via Docker containers. So, you know, however your organization is managing, deploying, and dealing with Docker, you can use that to run Tonic. Initially, we supported just Docker Compose. And by support, I mean we would provide you with a Docker Compose YAML file that you could use. If you wanted to use, you know, Kubernetes, ECS, EKS, AKS, whatever, that was on you and we would be there to help. But, you know, it's not something that we like had documentation for ready to go. I think supporting Docker Compose out of the gate was definitely the best move. I think a lot of startups now would probably go straight to Kubernetes. And I think that is likely a mistake. Getting it set up, getting it running is typically like there's more of a learning curve. And I've seen this a lot lately where I think like when you're starting off, just go with the simplest thing, even if it's not the sexiest. And, you know, Docker Compose, I think, really fits that bill, especially if you're just getting started with self-hosted deployments.
Yeah. Do I agree or do I disagree? I guess I mostly agree in the sense that like the fastest thing is so important, especially in the very, very beginning. Like you just need to get it to work somewhere. But with that said, like Kubernetes obviously has like a lot of benefits in production. And there, you know, actually one thing, self-hosted versus cloud, there is a difference actually that the capabilities that Tonic has, if you're in Kubernetes, is greater than the capabilities that you have in Docker Compose. Because like Docker Compose, you know, Kubernetes is like a real thing that Tonic can interact with. And so it can do stuff with it to, you know, like upgrade itself or spin up node or pods for the purposes of doing various actions and what have you. So there are actually a greater feature set in Kubernetes deployed Tonic than Docker composed Tonic.
But not, we didn't add those things till much later.
Yeah, much later.
Starting out, keep it simple. I mean, if you can get away with just a Docker run command, like just put everything in a single container, I would do that. Andrew, do you remember we had that one prospect early on where they're like, oh no, everything has to be in one Docker container. We won't run four containers. So we built that.
Yeah.
What did we call it? We had a name for it. Like the Omni container. Is that what we called it?
Yeah, something like
so
that.
So Andrew had to like overnight, he had to go like create a single container build that ran I think initially Tonic had three containers it ran with three different processes. So Andrew had to go build like the Omni container, which ran all three processes at once. And he had to basically do it overnight so he could deploy the customer the next day. And of course, the customer never converted, or rather the prospect never even converted. It was a huge pain in the butt. We ended up maintaining that stupid container for months.
What
a disaster.
The monolith container.
Yeah, you know, I got to learn about some stuff there. At least I learned some stuff, you know, in terms of technology.
We also learned, I mean, it took us more learnings to really get there. We learned not to do things like that eventually, I think. Or we're getting better at like saying no to these types of requests. And Andrew's better at saying no than I am. I'm a real pushover sometimes. But like it oftentimes is just not advantageous to do.
The thing that I about saying no, which is kind of random topic, but the thing that I've learned about saying no is that actually, like, you don't try to guess what their reaction is going to be. Like, if you think their reaction is like, oh no, they'd really need this or whatever, and then you tell them no, and it's like, they're like, okay,
quite often they'll say something like, we were just checking, but no worries, and you're like, oh,
exactly.
We've already spent 2 hours trying to, you know, how are we going to say no to them? And
Right. Like, don't sweat it so much. Also, it's not going to ruin, like, if you say no, it's not going to ruin the relationship, probably.
No.
You know, like, unless they're really not serious. And if they're not serious, then they weren't going to be a customer anyway.
That's right.
You know, if saying no to something small ends the deal didn't exist.
These are clearly all good pieces of advice given given where Tonic is today. Certainly something I'm going to be taking notes of, because the product I'm working on is very much at the early stages of where Tonic was when you're talking about saying no. And Docker Compose, I'm also thinking about not putting out blog posts with silly titles anymore, and thinking just to skip that part. So
I don't, that wasn't a net negative, at least. Okay, so if you got a funny title, if it makes you laugh, I think it's fine.
Yeah, net neutral.
There we go.
Yeah,
net neutral.
So given that things have worked out, let's look to where the product is now. And I believe we have three sort of follow-on products: Textual, Ephemeral, and Validate. So shall we dive into all three? Where would you like to start?
Andrew, let me set the stage for you to talk about Ephemeral. So if everyone recalls, I was saying, hey, when you subset data down, you can do cool things like put it in Docker containers so developers can just pull those containers down. But you can make it even better, and that's where Ephemeral comes into play. Andrew, over to you.
So Ephemeral is our latest product for test data infrastructure. There is a lot of great products out there for production data infrastructure, things like RDS and the equivalents in Azure and Google Cloud. But if you want test data infrastructure, actually things like RDS are like kind of antagonistic to being test data infrastructure. If you accept like the defaults in RDS, just spin up a default RDS instance. I calculated this a while ago, but and I don't remember the exact figure, but it's like going to cost you thousands of dollars a year. And test data infrastructure doesn't need that level. Like a lot of the defaults are things like multi-AZ. Like test data infrastructure does not need to be redundant and backed up in multiple AZs. Test data infrastructure, you know, at RDS, if you shut down an RDS instance, it even has like this warning, like we're going to start you back up in a week so that we can apply patches and stuff like that. I've personally shut down an RDS instance, forgot that I shut it down, and then a month later realized, oh, I've just been burning through credits because, you know, it just started itself back up. And so we really wanted to build great test data infrastructure and like test data infrastructure tools. And so that's where Ephemeral comes in. It is an ephemeral database, and it works really well with things like subsetting because it's intended to be lightweight, really quick to bring up, really quick to shut down, really easy with APIs to drive, and a very self-service user interface for individual developers. So we have like two main use cases we're targeting with Ephemeral. The first one, and these aren't ordered, just the first one I'll mention, is automated API-driven Ephemeral environments. And so that would be for your CI/CD. If you need a database during testing, you know, CI/CD, such a critical part of modern, you know, software development, it wants things to be as fast as possible. Like there's nothing that are going to make your developers more grumpy than adding 10 minutes to your CI/CD, you know? 10 minutes is an anathema. At least at Tonic, we would never allow that to be merged if it was going to add 10 more minutes to our CI/CD. And as organizations grow, I mean, I've worked at organizations where the CI can take like 3 hours or whatever, and even longer. But you know, you want to keep that as tight as possible. And so waiting for infrastructure to start, like if you put like an RDS instance start in your CI, that's like a non-starter. And people don't as a result. You know, instead, what they do is they run a long-running RDS instance that is up 24/7 and it's just available like when the CI needs it or whatever. But they're just like burning cash when they don't actually need it, right? And you know, if you set it up accidentally as multi-AZ, you're burning like twice the cash you need to be burning to make that work. So that's one use case, is the automated CI kind of use case. And the other use case is developer ad hoc needs. So I was just playing around with yesterday with Ephemeral because I needed a test database for a bug that I thought I saw. And I was like, did this bug actually happen? I should try to repro it. And I needed a database to do it. And I just used Ephemeral for that because it makes it really easy to pick a database that I know is going to be filled with the test data that I need. And it starts it up really, really quick. And it shuts it down really quick. The other thing that Ephemeral has is it's like the opposite of RDS, where RDS will automatically start your database after a week. Ephemeral will shut down your database automatically depending on inactivity. So if your database hasn't been used for the last 3 hours, it's just going to shut it down. Now, the good news is Ephemeral is so quick at bringing your database back up that it's not a big inconvenience if actually you needed that database. So you can bring it right back up, bring it back to life. And it works really well with Tonic, of course, right? Like Tonic provides test data. Ephemeral provides test data infrastructure. It's providing that place for that data to live. And of course, things like subsetting feature really heavily because subsetting, you know, it shrinks the data down. And Ephemeral, actually, the technology behind what makes Ephemeral so fast is, I wouldn't say scale independent, but it's got a very constant on your scale. So a very small constant on your scale. So it's actually quite fast, even if you have a lot of data. But you're probably, if your test data infrastructure, or rather test data, you don't need lots of data. So shrinking it down beforehand with subsetting and putting it in Ephemeral is just a really smart and good idea, and one that we enable really well with the Tonic suite of tools. So yeah, that's kind of Tonic Ephemeral in a nutshell. I'll just recap the highlights. One is, you know, it's test data infrastructure first. You know, we designed it as test data infrastructure, unlike RDS, which was designed originally as production data infrastructure. That means that it's really quick to bring up and really quick to bring down because we know test data infrastructure needs those things. And it comes pre-populated with data, meaning like you can save kind of the snapshot of a database with the data and then recreate that database. And it really targets these two use cases: developer ad hoc testing, just needing a database to tool around with for a day or a week, and the automated CI API based deployment of test data infrastructure for continuous integration.
Andrew forgot the most important part about Tonic Ephemeral.
Oh no.
Yes.
What's the most important part?
Your listeners can go create free accounts today. You can learn more at tonic.ai/ephemeral. And from there, you can either book a demo or just go and create your free account and start, you know, spinning up test data infrastructure basically immediately. It's a great experience. I encourage everyone to go try it. If it's not clear to you, Gregor, Andrew's a better engineer than I am, but I'm a little better at selling. So that's where I pride myself.
I was going to ask, so how does a developer get up and running with Ephemeral? But actually, I was going to ask more to the, I mean, because we're going to cover a couple more products based Tonic products in a second. I was curious, yeah, how it does it, when you're getting up and running, can you just sign up to Ephemeral, or are you signing up to a Tonic account total, or how does that
They're
work?
Separate, yeah, right okay. now. I yeah. mean, that's just like a, I think if design and some engineers had their way, we would like first develop some sort of like unifying mechanism. But back to Adam's point, like the only thing that matters is getting it out there. And like, we did not develop the unifying OAuth whatever thing to like allow all Tonic projects to be under one.
Right. That doesn't get us like more customers. Two separate. You know, it's like, it's something that it's a nice to have that we can add later. People will appreciate it. It's not the paradigm shift, the game changer that, you know, we're constantly searching for as you know, founders of the company. So should I talk about our other two offerings quickly?
Yeah, fantastic.
Excellent. So we have two other offerings. These other offerings are actually slightly further afield from Tonic's core offering of de-identifying and synthesizing data primarily for dev and test use cases. The first offering that I'm going to speak about is called Tonic Textual. It's kind of meant to be a stark contrast to Tonic Structural, the products that we've been talking about up until this point. Tonic Textual takes unstructured text data. It could just be raw text, or it could be text sitting in a file like in a PDF or a Word document or even an image. And it will identify the sensitive bits of information within that text and then redact or synthesize the text. There's two primary use cases. The first is actually very similar to like Tonic's core use cases of dev and test. Let's say you're an engineer that's built an unstructured data pipeline. That is to say, you have an S3 bucket filled with Word docs or PDFs, and you want to take all of this data and build a pipeline that eventually lands it in some type of structured form, like in a database table somewhere. So you build this pipeline, but now you have to test it. So you can use Tonic Textual to generate synthetic or fake PDFs, Word documents, text files, etc., to test your ETL pipeline, essentially. That's a very Tonic Structural-esque use case. It's for the same customer, the same user. It's just unstructured versus structured data. But there's a better use case for Tonic Textual, or I shouldn't say better, they're both good, but it's the use case, and the reason that we built Tonic Textual is actually for data scientists. So I'm a data scientist. I am starting to get into, you know, generative AI. I want to go build chatbots or RAG applications or just applications that are using my company's unstructured data as its backbone. Like maybe I want to build an internal chatbot or even an external chatbot. Maybe I'm a healthcare company. I have troves of chat transcripts between patients and doctors. I want to build a chatbot that can help answer questions like as the front line on my website. Well, to do that, I need to de-identify and redact all of those transcripts before I train my model so that I prevent data leakage when it's actually being used. So Tonic Textual is great for that use case. The form factor is, well, there's two form factors. We have a UI where you can just upload files and download redacted versions. But then we have an SDK that fits very well into existing like data science applications. And that's primarily meant for data scientists that are trying to de-identify and synthesize text prior to like fine-tuning and training generative AI models. And that's where we see a lot of usage as well. And that's the use case that I'm personally most excited about. I very much like that use case. I think it's cool. I love that Tonic is kind of expanding into additional, you know, customer profiles. That's always, you know, exciting to see. Folks can try that out at tonic.ai/textual. That will take you to a landing page where you can learn more. And then there's a very big button at the top that says create free accounts. And that allows you to create an account and try it out today. I think we give you, 100,000 words per month for free. But that might change by the time you create your account. And that'll allow you to like, you know, try things out and give it a go to see if it works for you. The other offering we have is called Tonic Validate. Tonic Validate is even further afield from our core offerings. Tonic Validate is a evaluation framework for LLM-backed applications. So what that means is, let's say you're building a RAG application, for example. You know, a RAG application is essentially an application that takes your company's data, and then when you ask questions to your LLM, the RAG system is retrieving just the necessary context from your company's underlying data to provide in the prompt to the LLM so that the LLM can give an answer. Of course, you can't send the LLM all of your company's data because it won't fit inside the context window. So the RAG application, its main purpose is to get the most important context so that we can fill the context window with the things that are most relevant for the question being asked. So you build this application, you're happy with it, but now you got to test it. Well, I mean, you know, typically with a test, it's like, okay, I give the application an input and this is the output I expect. You know, when you're using LLM-based applications, it's a bit different, right? A, they don't have to be deterministic. And B, the quality of the answer provided by your RAG application or the quality of the answer from the LLM, it's very subjective. Right? Like it doesn't have to be. It could be like, hey, what was the contract start date for this contract? Okay, well, that's the answer is just going to be a date. It doesn't really change. But it could be a question like, hey, what's the best way to get started doing X, X, and X, right? Like, whatever that is, right? Well, that answer is going to be very subjective. And how do you test that? So Tonic Validate essentially hooks into your LLM-based application, and then it can evaluate responses from your large language model. And it can provide scoring metrics to tell you, hey, how is the quality of this application and the answers it provides changing over time? And our customers typically integrate this into CI/CD pipelines so that every time you're making changes to your LLM application or to your RAG application, what have you, you're getting information about how answer quality is changing. And then you can see over time, you can be like, hey, wait a second, quality just dipped. You know, let's go to that commit. Let's kind of see what happened. Let's make some changes, et cetera. So think of it as a test tool specifically for LLM-backed applications.
Got it. So, I mean, I'm curious. This sounds like we, at Tonic, there's quite a sort of fully featured product suite, almost, if you want to call it that now. But, I mean, there must have been many areas that you could have explored and gone to. And, you know, now it's quite focused now down to ephemeral, textual, and validate. How did you kind of arrive at these sort of three extra offerings?
It's the right time and place. Just like, you know, I answered that earlier when you said, how did I get started with Tonic? Well, I was in the right place at the right time. For Validate and Textual, there are different answers for each. For Textual, I mean, we talk with our customers every day. We learn what they need, you know, where their pain is, you know, like what's missing in the market. And we just got enough requests about de-identifying and redacting unstructured text that it's like, oh, we have to do this. And really, those requests started coming in when Gen AI became big. Like the need for de-identifying and synthesizing text for Gen AI purposes is clear. The use case is clear. And that's when we started seeing an influx. And we were luckily in the right place at the right time, meaning we had a company, we had customers, we have good relationships with our customer, good relationships with our customers, and they let us know, you know, what's missing. Validate was born out of a failure. We were building our own RAG application offering that we decided was not good. But when we were building it, we built a really cool test framework so that we could kind of see how our application was doing. And we thought that application, like the test framework, was so nifty that we decided to open source it and then build a web UI around this open source offering. And that's what we have today. And by the way, I didn't mention this, but you can check it out, tonic.ai/validate. And Andrew, how did we get on Ephemeral? Like, do you know the history of that?
Yeah, I think, honestly, we were just like looking at our main offering and like what would complement it really well. Like, what else could we sell to our customers? And we had the test data, but we didn't have the test data infrastructure. And we saw a gap there in the market, right? Like I said earlier, RDS, the default settings in RDS are really kind of antagonistic to being used as test data infrastructure. And there weren't that many offerings in the space for it. So we thought this could be a place that, you know, we could add some value in the market and that the market would reward us. And so far that's true. So that's great. So yeah, Ephemeral might have been like a little bit simpler in terms of its origin. It was just sort of like, well, what else do we need? And what else do our customers need? Perfect. Let's build that.
It aligns so well with our vision of like the test data space. It's not coupled tightly to our core Tonic offering, but it sits adjacent to it like very nicely. Yeah, you're right, Andrew. It's just, I guess, less exciting or less complex of a backstory.
What team changes or what's the makeup of the team, especially I'm curious on the engineering side. I guess you've gone from one core product effectively to four. How does that team, are they distributed across the different products, or was that quite, is it not that way at all? I'm curious.
Yeah, we do distribute them among the different products. So we have a team that's basically dedicated to Ephemeral. We have a team that's basically dedicated to Textual and Validate. And then we have teams dedicated to Tonic and like Tonic Structural, I should say. You know, Tonic Structural is still the majority because that's where the majority of our customers are and the majority of our revenues are, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it's actually kind of beneficial to have a smaller team in the beginning because when it's smaller, everyone knows what everyone's doing. And so you can kind of get away with less in terms of ceremony and process. Oh, yeah. And even things like, I mean, this might be an anathema to some of your listeners, but even things like testing processes with a really small team, everyone knows what everyone's doing. So people don't make mistakes as much in terms of like, oh, I didn't even realize that feature existed. Well, you know, because there's your neighbor is the one who made it and there's only three of you or whatever, you know, back when Tonic first started, and it was basically me and Adam and maybe one other engineer coding on it, we didn't have very many tests and we didn't need them. Honestly, we just like the software quality wasn't that bad. It's only as the team grew and grew and grew that people become unaware of the impacts of their changes. And it's not just the team growing, it's the code base growing, right? So the code base grows and you become less aware of how things are coupled in unusual ways. And that's where the gotchas start happening, the regressions start happening. And now, of course, we have pretty robust test suites. But in the very beginning, no, we didn't have test suites. Also, test suites don't sell. Like, you start in your company. I'm just going to throw this out here. Hot take, test-driven development, not a good place to start if you don't have any customers. If you don't have any customers and you're worried about test-driven development, I don't know. I probably made some enemies.
Not for me. You did not. You should just be throwing as much crap at the wall as you can and seeing what sticks. That's the only approach that you should take. I'm going to add on to what Andrew said about small teams. It's probably like a second order effect. I think what Andrew said is probably more important and more relevant. But initially, when you're building a new product, like you don't always know what to build. And like you rely a lot on feedback. And that feedback initially is like few and far between because you just don't have a lot of conversations happening with prospects, right? It's just that you never get the attention you think you're going to get, right? So if you have a larger team, what ends up happening is, you know, you have good engineers. They want to make a difference. They want to help. They start building stuff, right? And it's almost never the right thing to build initially. So when you have a larger team working on a brand new product, people end up bolting on a lot of stuff that is just not really adding value. And it's probably detrimental because it's code that's never going to be exercised. It doesn't have tests. It's adding to complexity. It's like no one's winning by this code being written, essentially. But when you have a small team, you get less of that. I think that is another like really nice benefit from kind of like starting small and then growing the team as slow as you, like truly like grow your engineering team as slowly as you can on new products. I only like to add people when it's like becoming painful. That's my, you know, experience.
It's a great tip. And yeah, I'm probably going to make some enemies as one of the hosts of SE Daily saying this, but I also agree test-driven development on an early product is definitely a waste of time and effort. If time is finite, you should not be writing tests. You should be writing features.
That's right.
Things that products customers want.
When your product fails to achieve product market fit, which is 99% of all products, including the ones that Andrew and I come up with, you know, you're not going to be thinking, darn, I wish I wrote more tests. You're going to be, you know, thinking a million other things.
So we're sort of starting to come to the end of the episode, but I'd love to hear, you know, some, maybe just some kind of, when you contextualize any of these products, whether it's the sort of the newer three or Tonic Structural, what are maybe a couple of examples, I don't know, of customers, you obviously maybe can't name them, but things that you've helped with and you're really proud of, like what has Tonic helped with, especially perhaps to the fact that people's data should not should have the human right of private data. Like what are a couple of things that come to mind when you think of proud deployments?
Yeah, and I think we can name some customers for sure because we have them on our website. And I think the first one that comes to mind is eBay for me. I mean, obviously it's like a big impact for Tonic because eBay is a big logo, but also a big impact for eBay. We really helped them through our subsetting technology create a better testing environment for their automated tests. They were struggling with being able to run automated tests against realistic data, and we really helped them solve that through our subsetting. And you know, Adam earlier in the call mentioned something about, you know, taking massive scale data down to gigabytes. They really do that at eBay. They have their production data is 8 petabytes, and what they extract from that iteratively, meaning like they extract many of these 1 gigabyte chunks, basically. I mean, they're not guaranteed to be a gigabyte, but they're basically about a gigabyte. And then they accumulate those in a test repository of test scenarios that they can run their automated tests against. And they wrote a whole blog post on this too, so you can check out eBay's blog to learn more about it. But I mean, that's a big impact for everyone, right? It was a big impact for eBay. It was a big impact for Tonic. It was a big impact for the people of the world because a lot of people use eBay. And so, you know, just made a better product for everyone, actually made a better eBay product, also made a better Tonic product. eBay was an early customer for Tonic. We had used subsetting in a couple places, you know, earlier to my conversation about subsetting and what's the great feature of subsetting. And then the second thing I said was like, well, and it works, right? Like it works in the production context. eBay taught us a lot about how it needed to work with Oracle in particular and with, you know, a really complex schema with lots of databases. I mean, they have hundreds of databases and then they also shard them. So you can think about that as, you know, thousands of databases that it's working across, which is pretty cool.
That was really pivotal for us when that started working. My answer to this question is it's less detailed. I'll just say I am most proud and happy when I see our customers using Tonic generated data across their environments. When we have customers that essentially all developers only use Tonic generated data, I just know that that's a customer that is happy. They have private, safe data. It's easy to access. It's higher quality. They are finding bugs faster and more reliably. And I really like that when customers like fully deploy Tonic across their organization.
Yeah, it is really rewarding. And then, and like just as a developer, I mean, putting myself in their shoes, it's sort of like every decision you make, so many little decisions a day as a developer. How big should this thing be? Like this, how big should this field be? Or, you know, how much space does this image going to take or whatever? And like having really good synthetic data for all those things makes every little decision you make, and having it deployed across an organization like that really enables that, which is really cool.
So Adam, I think you've already helped us out a few times during the episode with links and how to see the products and get hands on. But for example, if a developer is listening today and, you know, time is precious, what's the kind of one entry point that you're thinking that you could say, like, a developer wants to get up and running with something Tonic product based? Where's the best place for them to go and get?
Oh my God, just go to tonic.ai. Our product page is right there. And for any of our products, you can go create free trials. Anything that we mentioned today, you can go create an account right now and begin using it. And these, of course, are accounts that are hosted in our multi-tenant cloud environment. You can use it, you can get a feel for it, see if you like it. And then if you like it, you can either, you know, basically use it in the cloud forever, or you can have a conversation with our sales team and we can discuss how to get you self-hosted, meaning running from your environments.
Nice. That's a pretty compelling offer. So Adam and Andrew, it has been very fantastic to speak to both of you today. I feel like I've been in the right place, right time today, just getting to speak to you and learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have as well. And yeah, I hope we can catch up again in the future sometime and hear how these newer products are going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Likewise.